Hey there, welcome to Data Democracy. This is a podcast where we explore ways to make data and AI more accessible to everyone. We do this by interviewing experts across industries, asking them how they think about data, what are some of the challenges they face when it comes to data, and if they had a magic wand and time and resources were not constraints, what kind of intelligence and models would they wish to have? We have a great guest today, Jim James. Jim is a global entrepreneur, PR guru, author of multiple books, and a podcaster. Jim has built businesses across three continents, has written fascinating books, including The Gap Year Cash, The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, Volume 1 and 2. Jim hosts a podcast, also called The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, where he works with entrepreneurs to help them grow and get noticed. I'm super excited to welcome Jim to Data Democracy. Jim, welcome.
Mitty, thanks so much for the glowing introduction. You know, you said it better than I could have said it myself. I had to get you to do my PR. Thank you for inviting me onto the show.
No, I'm super excited to have you on and learn from you. Let's start with your story. You've got an inspiring story. You're more from the UK to Singapore at 28, founding your company, writing books and hosting your podcast. Tell us your story.
Well, thank you. I think it all started when I jumped out of a plane at the age of 17, Mitty, really. You know, I was trying to raise money to go overseas to Australia from the UK, working by the hour. I knew I'd never make enough money. So I jumped out of an aeroplane and got it sponsored by people in the toy department that I was working in, actually selling toys to children. And I really learned from that episode, the jumping out of a plane and raising enough money to go to Australia and then getting the local newspapers to report me buying some clothes and some boots and backpacks and so on from a local store in exchange for coverage. I learned that actually you can make money not by earning it by the hour, but by creating something from nothing. And that's really, for me, the start. So at 27, after a few years of working for other people and finding sitting in meetings not really for me, I moved to Singapore to start my first business, East West Public Relations, which is still operating, in fact, eastwestpr.com. And I sold it to a couple of young PR gurus that are now running the business.
That's awesome. It's a really fascinating story. I know you've got businesses across, you know, multiple countries, and you've had a long career. What are some of the unexpected challenges and surprises you've encountered in your global career?
Yeah, you mentioned about going on to other countries. Just to fill that in, after Singapore for 12 years, I moved to China, Mitty, to start the public relations company, but also then started opening the import business for a sports car company, a drinks company, and started the British Business Awards in China. And the other continent was India, actually, where I opened an office in Bangalore. So I've been fortunate enough to start businesses on many continents and many different kinds of businesses. I think that one of the challenges that you face as an entrepreneur anywhere is the physical challenge, because you have to be self-motivated, and running a business is a marathon, not a sprint. And I think that for all of us, I'm 57 now, so I'm at the end of things. The challenge of staying fit and healthy, when at the beginning, when you start an agency, you don't feel like your health is that important, because you think it's all about money and ideas and networking. So one of the challenges that I've had to overcome is changing the way that I address and look after myself. I actually had a tumor, grew a tumor, not intentionally, I can say, but I discovered I had an ameblastoma when I was living in Beijing. And that's kind of a rare disease, but it's fatal in 5% of people, and it's not pleasant. Part of your jaw disintegrates. And that was really a wonderful, wrong word maybe, but a great reminder that there is no wealth without your health. So I think the first challenge as an entrepreneur is to recognize that the big goal is actually your longevity, not your profitability. So that would be perhaps the first challenge. Second challenge, I think, when you run a business is you're learning new things. You're learning to do product marketing, maybe development, cash flow, HR, tax, finance. If you're trying to learn those things in your own country, then you can ask people that you know, and the language may be the same. I was a bit of a fool, really, Mitty, because I went to Singapore, so I learned those, how to run a business in an entirely new culture. This is back in 95, so we didn't really have the internet. We're just the beginnings of Yahoo and no mobile phones. So that was a challenge, was, if you like, learning enough quickly enough. And then when I went to China in 2006, I had to learn again. So one of the challenges as an entrepreneur is that we have to continue to learn. And we're learning while we're doing. And finding this balance between doing things that you know work and exploring new things that you don't know will work yet is central to being an entrepreneur, because we're always the ones who are leading a business and moving it forward. Whereas if you are an employee, of course, you have someone, an organization or a boss, who has made that decision for you. So I think that constant challenge of learning and doing simultaneously is another challenge. So that's two good challenges. I don't want to put anybody off being an entrepreneur, so I don't want to say too many, but those are perhaps two: retaining your health and continuing to learn whilst doing.
Yeah, those are really great insights. You did mention about, you know, longevity and health. It reminded me of an interview I was watching of Robert Downey Jr. He basically said, I've got my acting down and I know how to emote and all that, but the best thing I can bring value, the best value that I can bring is to bring my A game and, you know, make sure that I'm healthy and in the right mindset. So I think that's really, that spoke to me. Continuing on, like you said, you've got a unique vantage point of starting businesses and running it in multiple countries and cultures. When it comes to business, what are the things that work across cultures and countries? What should entrepreneurs focus on no matter where they're doing their business?
I think the universal truths in running a business, probably a couple. One is that central to any company, whether it's a software or a hardware, you're selling fruit, you're delivering medical supplies, is you have to add value. It seems an obvious thing to say, but often people get caught up with what they want to produce and forget that what's most important is what people want to buy. Now, I know this is antithetical to the Steve Jobs or even the Ford. You know, if I ask people what they wanted, they want faster horses. But actually, if you look at it this way, people wanted transport, right? And the intuition was that they would do that through through cars, or people wanted mobile telephony. Okay, so actually people did want those things. It's just how we would have them that's different. So first of all, I think that we have to remember that we're adding value, because if we're not, no one's going to give us any money. Universal. The second element about business, again, I don't know whether I'm teaching anybody anything new here, but it really does come down to people. It comes down to the people that you sell to, you know, liking what you offer them, trusting you, working with you if things aren't quite right and not trying to make life difficult for you. It comes down to the people that help you to deliver that good and service. So whether it's in Singapore or India or China, and I've worked in America and lived in Africa as well, you know, you can't create anything on your own. Business is a team sport. And even if you are a solopreneur, you need vendors, you need suppliers. Even if you're buying everything software as a service, you need someone who's on a help desk that can help you figure out your domain name. So the second point really, Mitty, is that business really relies on people. And so no matter where you are in your entrepreneur life, you should enjoy and take comfort in that, because essentially as people, building relationships with other people is actually the most joyful thing in the world. And as an entrepreneur, really everybody and anyone can do that. There is no barrier to having relationships. It's not a technical, it's not a financial, it's not a legal barrier. So the universal truth really is that, you know, we are all in relationships trading with one another. And the rest is an application, it's an approach and so on. But those would be two universal truths that I've learned over the last 25, 30 years.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You mentioned about, you know, bringing customers are actually asking entrepreneurs to solve problems, not necessarily how to, right? That's the engineers and entrepreneurs' job to understand how to. But like you said, people were asking a faster, quicker way of transportation, not necessarily the intuition, like you said, was, okay, just improve what we have. Maybe that's a problem-solving issue that the engineers and entrepreneurs need to solve.
Exactly, Mitty. So people were racing faster and faster horses. They're trying to get faster and faster. They were feeding them better grain instead of grass. So people were innovating around faster transport. So the entrepreneur's role is to see that gap. And the joy of being an entrepreneur is you try and build, create, innovate something that solves the need that the market has but hasn't yet fulfilled the need for.
So it's not that customers cannot tell you about your next product. It's about customers do not necessarily need to tell you how to build your product. They just need to tell you, you just need to understand what are the problems that they want solved.
Exactly. And that's really what our role as entrepreneurs is to, you know, watch what people do, listen to what people say, and be sensitive to those needs. And that's why I say business comes down to people, because if you have empathy around what people are struggling with, what their aspirations are, then you can understand what kind of product, good, or service that you can deliver to that need.
That's a great point. In my work, I've helped businesses, business teams, marketing teams, sales operations, and lots of teams with data and AI, but I've never dived into public relations. We're just starting to do, you know, dipping our toes into it. So for a novice like me, how would you explain the world of PR?
Public relations is really about how a company or an individual communicates to those people actually inside and outside the organization, as opposed to intimate relations, I suppose, where you talk to maybe a friend about what you would like to tell them about your emotional well-being. So public relations really is about sharing with those different communities, what we call stakeholders, internal and external and partners, what you're trying to accomplish and what your vision is, and maybe what's going right with that vision and what's not going quite right with that vision. So the way I look at public relations is it's a way to engage those stakeholders in the forward progress of the company. And we do that through communicating through the media, through traditional press, through podcasts, which is a growing medium as we're doing now. And I've just launched a podcast guest blueprint, which is a course for anyone that wants to be on a podcast, how to get on a podcast, but also how to create connections so that you get leads from those podcasts as well. So public relations is about taking that thought that you have as a as an entrepreneur and putting into different formats, be it a video, be it a written press release, being an article, being it a podcast in audio, or even going out and speaking to people. So public relations is really about how you communicate what your company is doing. That's not a sales message. It's about how you as an organization are addressing an issue or a community, for example, as opposed to this is what I'm selling, which is quite tactical and a transfer of value. So I hope that explains what it's about, then trying to help people to move from maybe a lack of understanding to a fuller understanding of what you're doing. And ultimately, you want people to engage in what you're doing, because if they engage with what you're doing, then they will become customers and advocates and help you to do that.
Got it. It's more organic or more natural than a sales transaction, you know, in a lot of ways, because you're not going, maybe down the line, but in that specific interaction, you're not really asking the customers for something else. You're just trying to educate them or bring awareness to your product.
Yeah, Missy, and in a way, I mean, in the marketing talk, we have, you know, we talk about funnels, right? And public relations really is helping people to understand which funnels they're going to be comfortable getting into, right? And the sale is, you like the company, you believe in the company, you've done your due diligence, and now you're going to have a transaction that buys that good or service that fits into your company or your home, right? So, but if you haven't understood what the company stands for, that the company will be around for a long period of time, and that they have integrity and they have authenticity, these are values, if you like, that you ascribe to a company, which go ahead if you wanted to buy from them. And that's really what public relations is doing. So it's helping people to understand the company better.
Do PR and brand awareness come under the same umbrella? Are they tangential but separate or the same? What's the relationship between the two?
Brand awareness, Mitty, really is the objective, right? Brand awareness is what you're hoping to get from public relations, advertising, maybe seminar speaking, podcasts, outdoor signage, where if people see the brand, it creates a response within the person, because a brand is a promise and it creates an emotional response to people and that brand. And because people will associate that brand with different aspects of their lives or different meanings, one brand can have a positioning, but it won't mean the same to everybody. McDonald's means one set of values and promises to one person and maybe something else to somebody else. Public relations is one of the ways that you can communicate the brand values. Okay, so, you know, public relations, even direct media, social media, outdoor events, speaking, podcasts, these all contribute to the brand. Mm-hmm. And where you have an advert, for example, will build an impression, a visual impression. I like the look of that, for example, but it doesn't really create any context. The public relations helps you to understand the context of that image and that brand and that message. So one actually needs to have an integrated approach, which is why you'll see big companies will have product launches, they'll have customer loyalty programs, they'll have after sales care, they'll have AI bots on their websites, they have customer reviews, they'll do trade shows. Right. So actually you need an integrated approach to build a brand.
Got it. So PR is one of the levers you have to reach the objectives, which would be brand awareness.
Exactly.
Got it. This may be a very broad question, but how do you improve PR or a brand of a company or a product? How do you measure the impact of your PR efforts?
Missy, you've got two questions in there. One is, how do you improve the PR, the, let's call it the awareness or the understanding, really? So in public relations, we'll first of all look at how you do that. And your second question was about measurement. So the first question is, how do you communicate about your company, your brand? The first is really to understand what the company stands for. And we've all heard of the missions and visions and so on. And then what public relations does is it looks for different ways for spokespeople in the organization to articulate those. It could be, for example, as an article that appears in a magazine or a newspaper. It could be appearing on TV, especially if there's a crisis management, for example, then someone needs to speak, for example, like Boeing. So a great example of the COO of Alaska Airlines, for example, was sitting on the Boeing MAX 737 on its first flight after the door had flown out. So that's a classic case for public relations, because they know that the perception of that airplane is that it's unsafe. So you have the COO of one of the biggest airlines flying next to the emergency exit on a plane, right? It's not advertising. It's not direct mail. That's PR. That's saying, we as a customer, me as an individual, I trust this brand. I'm willing to literally sit next to the door to make sure it works. So PR is about going out and being seen, whether it's in writing or in person, and articulating the values of that company. Okay. And the way to do that is through consistency. I have a strap line for my podcast, The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, and on the book and in the podcast guest blueprint course, keep on communicating. Right? It's very simple, but we are actually all required to keep on communicating, because if we don't communicate, it's the time when people say no comment, for example, if they're asked after a trial. The assumption from everybody is if they're not commenting, there must be something wrong. We can't help but communicate. We're actually always communicating, even when we're not saying something. So to build a public relations campaign, it needs to be consistent over time. Consistency doesn't necessarily mean frequency, by the way. It doesn't mean that you have to produce content every day. Great music bands, movie franchises like James Bond, they don't come out every day or every week. But there is consistent communication when they do come out, that you have expectation around them. So you have to be consistent. And what you also have to do is to be consistent with the language. You know, public relations requires consistency of language, because people will hear something and it'll take 7 or 8 times for them to believe it. So if you say it one time, people may have not even heard it. The second time, maybe they have. Third or fourth time, it becomes repetition to you, but to the audience, it becomes reinforcement. So we have to bear in mind when we do public relations that we actually need to be almost consistently dull and keep on communicating and move the conversation along at the pace that the audience is ready to, not the pace that the internal organization believes is going to be right. Often the people inside a company think, oh, I shared that last week, I can move on. But actually, people outside the organization haven't necessarily heard it, haven't necessarily bought into it, haven't necessarily processed it. So keep on communicating consistently over time. That's the essence of public relations. If we look at measurement, measurement used to be, back in the early days, in column inches. We used to literally buy newspapers and measure the column inches, and clients would pay us for the amount of column inches. Or they would certainly motivate you and incentivize you, say, if you don't get this many column inches, you're not doing your job. Another agency can get that for me. So it used to be that companies like Karma, which is actually started in Australia, there are measurement companies like Karma. And they would, in the old days, buy the newspapers and clip them for you. Now, of course, we've moved into digital and technology is doing listening. There are companies like Karma is still doing it. We have people like Ramayaki and Curtis doing it, but also some new entrants like Talkwalker are doing not just the how often your company is mentioned, but what we call sentiment analysis. And sentiment analysis is the new, if you like, the new part that is enabled by AI. We used to read a newspaper article back in the mid-90s when I did this, and you'd look for keywords and say it's positive or negative, and you'd manually put it into a spreadsheet. But on my podcast, The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, Mitty, I have some of the originators of these technologies. And these really sort of technopreneurs have built the software now that helps basically review audio, video, text, and look for not just the keywords anymore, but the context and the structure. So now we can measure in real time what people are saying about our company or about our competitors, whether it's positive, negative. And in the case of one company called Serrano out of America, they can then use that to see whether people have got buying intent, whether those people that are on social media should be targeted with an advert. So we're seeing now the joining up, Mitty, of commentary online with buying intent. So measurement of public relations now is absolutely a core part of any strategy. And it's really, really exciting because you can then alter the strategy, frequency, messaging type. Also, by geography, for example, now you can have websites that are location specific or even customer journey specific. And there's a company in Holland that's got a software that, depending on where you have come from, your customer journey, will serve you different content on the website. So they've also been on my podcast. So at theunnoticed.cc, you'll find actually 750 plus episodes with interviews of entrepreneurs that are really shaking up territory when it comes to public relations.
That is fascinating. Yeah, you really, yeah, I think you're on the at the top 3% of the podcast. So, I mean, I'd definitely encourage our customers to check it out. It's a really good listen.
Thank you very much indeed. And it's as good as the people I have on the show. So I'm very blessed that people from around the world, entrepreneurs, come on the show and will share with me their innovations on really ways that entrepreneurs can use free and creative tools to get noticed.
That's very useful. Yeah, I mean, but going back to your answer, I think, it's really, like I said, I'm really dipping into it. And I think we have a tool called YouGov, which is a British company that we're using for brand awareness measurement. And they kind of do some of those things, like measure the sentiment of people across the globe about our company, or, you know, depending on what area, geography that we cater to. I think one of the important things that came to my head was with the digital tools, it's so easy to change strategies in real time. You know, you're getting feedback in real time versus, you know, newspaper clipping and things like that. So it's much more robust and helpful, but also it ties back to your the other insight that you don't want to change the messaging or consistency of messaging. You got to keep the messaging consistent, but you can't change the strategy. How you reach out to them could be changed, but not really the messaging itself.
Well, Missy, the way of looking at it is that the company isn't changing dramatically that quickly, right? You know, if you think about a big company, it hasn't overnight decided to have a new business model or a new customer focus. So what we're looking for in creative public relations is about finding new ways to illustrate that message or that proposition, finding maybe new case studies, finding new applications, finding new ways that it might resonate. What may change is an innovation, an iteration, for example, a new software release, or there may be something that happens in the marketplace where then people are using the product in a different way. So if we look at mobile phones, when we got the camera on the phone, all of a sudden people went, oh, that's useful, but what would you use it for? And we just took pictures. And then TikTok came along, and all of a sudden there's a whole new category. Well, if you're providing phones, the marketing changes from we have a camera on the phone that you can take a picture of yourself to you can do streaming to your social media channels. Same product, the market's changed, so the message evolves as well. But that consistency that you're innovating, that you've got a camera, would remain the same, right? So that's really what we're looking at. And that is kind of the joy of public relations, is it's such a dynamic field, as indeed all the marketing fields are. Very, very exciting.
Yes, absolutely. Like I said, I'm still dipping into PR and brand awareness efforts. Can you please tell us the difference between aided and unaided surveys, which is a tool used to measure brand awareness?
Actually, I think there you're talking about really whether you've got somebody taking a test or a quiz online, for example, and we've all got those. I've just got one actually from the British government to help them understand demographics in my area. And you can use tools like ScoreApp, for example, now where if you're running a survey, you can create a survey for people and it gives them real-time kind of responses and configured responses to their questions. That's leaving the individual to make decisions about their responses. And you really have to structure the questions very carefully, because the questions in an unaided survey are literally open to interpretation. If you're guided in the same way maybe YouGov is doing, or Ipsos Mori, for example, who also came on the show on the Unnoticed Entrepreneur podcast, they are doing guided surveys where they're going to people and they're asking people what, you know, their thoughts are about a particular subject. And depending on the response, then they're taking that person, that respondent, to, if you like, down a decision tree A or a decision tree B. So the guided response gives much more depth of understanding. And so presumably it's either costs more money or you survey fewer people. There is a company in America called Pick4You that also came on the Unnoticed Entrepreneur podcast. They're quite interesting because it's almost a hybrid, Mitty. So what happens there is that if you're going to launch a new product or a service, you put it on the Pick4You website and you can choose the demographics and you can create options and you can leave a video. And actually, you can let the survey base make decisions and respond to your product. And it's being used, for example, for product packaging on Amazon. So we're getting this blend, really, because of digital technology, of the guided and the unguided becoming, you know, kind of overlapping in a way. What you really obviously have to do is to look for the output. You know, are you looking for a statistical justification of a theory, or are you looking for guidance on the theory? The unguided will give you some statistical result that you can interpret. The guided, you could listen more and watch more, and that will give you more intuitive results.
Got it. Like you said, guided is more in-depth, knowing a little more about what the customers are wanting, feedback from the customers, versus unaided, or that would be more about, hey, what is the measure of your brand awareness or any theory or hypothesis that you have.
Yeah, and it may be maybe more open questions. So, for example, a guided question could be, how do you feel about my brand? Because most people are not necessarily going to want to write that down for you. Maybe they don't have the time, don't have the interest. So if you're doing inquiry rather than validation is the way I'd look at it, Mitty. Okay, so inquiry is, who, what, why, where, when, and how, open questions. And then unguided is on a scale of 1 to 5. Do you agree with this statement, yes or no? Okay, so you have a different structure of question because actually your objectives are different depending on the kind of interview that you want to hold.
That makes sense. That makes sense. What's the role of data in PR? We talked about measurement and, well, yeah, what is the role of data in PR? How important is it, and how do you use data to drive your decisions?
Well, data's become more and more important, I think, across all marketing disciplines, right? And the real issue here now in PR and others is in attribution. So in the old days, Mitty, you'd say, get an article in the Wall Street Journal, for example, and it would be anecdotal. I used to get my clients on Bloomberg or CNBC, and it'd be like, oh, somebody mentioned they saw me, right? It would be anecdotal. Now, because we can track where people have seen or read and the behavior through software, I had the founder of a company called Funnelytics on my show, for example. Funnelytics can track all the sources of traffic to your funnel, right? Because you have more than one landing page and more than one funnel. And it tracks it across the entire universe, whether it's you've been found on a website from a blog post or a TV show that someone streamed and watched on CNN, all the way back to maybe the Facebook account that they tracked it on to whether they shared it. So the digital customer journey that we all have now, the footprint that we leave across devices, even though now, of course, we have more and more privacy rules in place, attribution has come to public relations as it has to every other discipline, whether it's, advertising or events where we used to do lead capture on the trade show booth. So public relations now is very measurable. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing because public relations plays a very valuable role at building credibility for a brand and starting conversations for a brand. So really, we've got now tools to say like Funnelytics that are helping with attribution all the way through. And there are some platforms like Taboola, for example, where it's called syndicated discovery content, where if you have an article, for example, you want to appear on CNN or BBC, you can put it onto Taboola. And you'll often see at the bottom of, for example, the BBC or CNN, it says syndicated content. And it may say Taboola or Outbrain. Outbrain was acquired by Taboola. And so public relations now is going into some content platforms as original content, as articles, but as actually as part of a syndicated content platform, which then has the full trail of where it appeared, how many times it got read, where people read it, and so on. So it's been tremendous to see in the last 25 years. I first met Jim McNamara in Singapore in 1996 when he started Karma, and he brought in a big stack of magazines and newspapers, and we went through it together and looked at how he was scanning those and then showing me in real time the kind of attribution. Now it's real time. Jim McNamara can stay in Australia, not travel around the world with a stack of newspapers. But public relations agencies can demonstrate to their clients the impact of what they do. And clients can see if the budget was well worth spending on public relations.
Yeah, it's a great tool to have, or great place to be, and time to be able to measure all your marketing efforts, especially with attribution. I mean, as a data guy, I think it's a double-edged sword. I want to just say, Everybody else, just stay quiet for 3 weeks. We're testing Jim's PR effort. Don't do anything on your end. We just want the data to be clean. But that never happens. But one day, I'll try.
We never have 3 weeks to wait because the world keeps moving on, right? Competitors do something. The market does something. So we're trying to get to real time. And we're getting very close, right? As you know, Mitty. So yeah, data attribution, I think every marketing discipline, and frankly, every function of the business, be it, you know, HR, whether finance, production, you know, Internet of Things in manufacturing has changed as well, how we monitor production processes. So data, as you know, because this is your field, not mine, is ubiquitous and mobile and constant.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really fascinating, the world of our digital marketing data. There's so much and it's always evolving. So it keeps me on my toes.
Yes, you're never going to be out of a job, Mitty. I think that's for sure.
Is there a difference in your approach when you're helping out an entrepreneur versus a small business versus a large company? You did mention about consistent messaging. Is there a difference in approach that you would have?
The fundamental necessity to be consistent and authentic is the same regardless of the organization, because ultimately you're trying to build a level of understanding and trust in the minds and hearts of all those people you need to deal with. And that's regardless of company size. The beauty of technology now really is that it democratizes the process. So the small company, the solopreneur, now has access to tools that can create content of a caliber that a big company would have spent thousands of dollars on. So there are tools like Descript, for example, or Veed.io or Lumen 5 that enable entrepreneurs to make videos or articles using platforms like Claude, for example, on Anthropic, that really enable the entrepreneur to create content of a level and a speed that they couldn't have done before. And the distribution tools like repurpose.io and then schedulers like Zoho or Buffer. Putting in place the infrastructure for a smaller company is harder, for sure. So I think the challenge when I work with clients, so I consult Mitty for, you know, business owners, and I help them to get these systems set up. The challenge for them is bandwidth, because they're trying to manage this along with maybe HR and finance and delivering things to customers. So that's really the difference. Whereas bigger companies maybe have an in-house marketing manager, or they can pay for an agency. So the principles are the same. But of course, what a smaller company has to think about is the earlier point I made about frequency. It's essential to still be consistent, but the bigger company can have more frequency across more channels. Whereas the solopreneur can choose one channel and be consistent. So for example, the solopreneur may have LinkedIn and a LinkedIn post once a week on a Thursday at 12 o'clock. They turn up every week on a Thursday with an article that maybe they wrote, or as I'm working with one client, we're using ChatGPT to help the beginnings of the article. And then we're using DALL-E to create the images. Okay. And then we put that into Claude, because Claude's actually quite a good long form writer. And then into Grammarly, because neither of those two platforms are as good at the grammar. So in the space of an hour, that entrepreneur can have an article that on a Thursday at 12 o'clock, they place into LinkedIn with a nice image. And that could be enough for them. But for the bigger company, maybe they're doing that twice a week on LinkedIn, but maybe they're also putting that onto Medium. And maybe they're also putting into YouTube, for example, a video. So as companies get bigger, they can approach more channels with more content. And almost by definition, they're going to have more customers. So they're going to need to be seen against more channels and with more content, but they'll also have more things going on. So I think the message to entrepreneurs is to start with what is manageable and not get overwhelmed by the need to be on Facebook or LinkedIn or X every day, all day. Because it's more than your customers really need anyway. They're just looking for reassurance. So I think that would be the difference. It's really about scale. The fundamental strategy of showing up consistently and authentically has to stay the same. The frequency changes. The channels change, Mitty.
That's a really good point. Okay. Yeah. Let's change gears and talk about Unnoticed Entrepreneur, your book and your podcast. What is your book, The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, about? Just a second. My AI assistant was, I don't know, Google picked up something. I don't know what it did. I'll cut this out.
Okay, well, that's why I don't talk in between, because it makes it easier to edit.
Appreciate it.
So, Mitty, you asked about my book. This is the first edition called The Unnoticed Entrepreneur, Step Into the Spotlight. This is published by Wiley under the Capstone imprint. And a big part of my view is that I'm really a facilitator, Mitty. You know, I know a little bit about entrepreneurship and about public relations, but there are many people who know much more. But also, the people that really entrepreneurs need to hear from are from fellow entrepreneurs. So what I've done with my podcast, now with, you know, 900 episodes on the video and also the audio and nearly 400 interview guests, is to take a selection of those interviews and make them into articles using actually some AI and some human interaction, and then to compile those into books. Because my view is, if I can help an entrepreneur to have, in effect, 50 conversations with entrepreneurs in the space of a book, that's hugely, hugely productive. I started the entrepreneurs organization, EO, the EO network, in Beijing when I was living there with a good pal called Rich Robinson. And this is back in 2007. And the most powerful thing we've done together, and that I've learned, is that it's peer sharing. It's learning from someone that's either in the same position or has been in the same position as you, and how they solve the problems you're facing. So the book series is entrepreneurs sharing how they got noticed, and it covers some technology, it covers some theory. And the first book that I published, I did on my own. And the second book I published on my own, and I entered the British Business Book Awards, Mitty. And amazingly enough, I was a finalist in the book category. And as a result, Wiley reached out to me on LinkedIn and said, would you be interested to publish under Wiley? So a couple of lessons in there. One is to enter awards. Great PR if you meet people, but also you might have a chance to win or get nominated. And the second is to then let people know you've done it. So actually, it was through PR, putting it on LinkedIn, that my book was found. So the second volume is coming out in April of this year, and it's available on Amazon now for pre-order, actually. So The Unnoticed Entrepreneur Volume 1, and then Volume 2 is another 50 conversations, and then there'll be a Volume 3, I think, in another year's time. So the idea is to take these amazing conversations I have with entrepreneurs that are all 20 to 25 minutes long, take them into text and make them accessible so they really become lessons that fellow entrepreneurs can learn from.
Yeah, that's like distilled down lessons that we can learn from in a shorter time span. That's awesome. It's fascinating, and it's so helpful for entrepreneurs and even, you know, people in professional jobs.
I think so. The response has been really good to the book because it's accessible and because it's 50 interviews, people can read one chapter at a time and it takes the length of a cup of coffee. So the idea is that you can dip in and out because entrepreneurs don't have a lot of time. And actually, they may just find one story. For example, like there's a photographer in India who during lockdown decided that he would take a picture of himself every day for 365 days because they couldn't go out. So he took pictures of himself every day and as a result, then built a calendar. And as a result of that, on Instagram, people said, hey, I love your work. Can we have you come and work with us? So really great stories of people doing things that are just creative and innovative, not expensive, but help them to get noticed.
That's awesome. In your book, you teach leaders and entrepreneurs about ways to be seen as an authority in the industries. Can you please talk to us about it? What are some of the ways to be a thought leader in an industry?
First of all, you have to think of something, Mitty. I know it sounds an obvious point, but you know, it's a bit like people say they want to get rich, but you have to do the work to get rich. And if you want to be known as an authority, you have to do something or believe in something or articulate something that establishes you as a thought leader. Sounds an obvious thing to say. But first of all, define what it is and not too broad and not too narrow either, ideally. So have some kind of a thesis that you believe in. Okay. I work with my sister, Dr. Shelley James, and what we did, we took her thesis, which was about the benefit of light, natural light on wellness. And then what we did, Mitty, was we gave her a title. We called her a luminologist. So the second thing you can do is think of some kind of brand positioning for yourself. It's great. You can have your own name. That works too. And you can create your own domain, own your own domain name, for example. You can create a logo for your personality, if you like. But it's quite a good idea to create some kind of a nomenclature. So I call myself the champion of the unnoticed entrepreneur, for example, okay? What do you stand for? And once you've got that, then you start to articulate that in terms of messaging. So with Shelley, for example, which is about the impact of light on wellness in schools, in hospitals, in prisons, in old people's homes. Same content, you know, rays of light, but in different verticals. And then what we can do is we can position that thought leader, in this case, Shelley, Dr. Shelley James, onto podcasts, writing articles on LinkedIn. So this is then where we get into the content production, all starting with that central premise, ideally with some kind of a brand proposition, and then start to create the content and go to the different channels. And it comes back down to creating content consistently over time. Okay, so that really is the way to start to build a brand. And then, of course, there are different hierarchies, if you like. So creating a blog on your own website, that's great. Ideally, what you do is you start to do public speaking. And then what we did with Shelley was then we moved her up to be a TEDx speaker. So then we got her onto TEDx and her speech was seen over 300,000 times in the first month. So she became a top speaker worldwide. So went to the TED stage. And then it's the book. So actually, I have mapped out a journey, Mitty, if anyone's interested in getting in touch with me, of the different steps that are required from going from being obscure to being in demand of being paid for sharing that central proposition that you've got. So there really is a workflow and a methodology. And really, it's very, very possible for anyone to do it.
That was so fascinating when I learned that from your work. But yeah, you've developed a methodology around it, and that was super fascinating to read through it. there is a science to it. I know we're coming short on time, so let me go to questions I'm interested to learn more about. What excites you about the current advancements in AI and data? You talked a lot about, you know, how you use some of these AI tools. Can you tell us more about it?
I think AI is so exciting because it's such an enabler, really, Mitty. You know, for people like me that can't draw or create images very well, using AI like DALL-E or Midjourney give me a superpower that otherwise I wouldn't have. They enable me to create content for courses at a speed that I couldn't hope to type. That's selfish, though, in that sense. I'm talking about me. But I think AI is also really, really exciting for all those people that have maybe some challenges. So, for example, if you are visually impaired, you know, AI is now helping people to take text into audio, for example, right? So it's possible now then to put text in and text to audio. You can have text on screens, for example, e-readers. So that's an enablement part as well, I think, of AI. I think AI is also enabling people to bring goods and ideas to market at a speed and with such a reduced level of risk. So I met some young people that have got a business plan evaluator, and you put the ideas in and it finds other businesses that are similar or not and evaluates the risks. So we're going to get into ideation and accessibility in a way that isn't possible. And I think it's very liberating because people in other markets, maybe, for example, maybe India, for example, where they may not have access to capital or infrastructure, they can create goods and services that can compete globally using the technology. So I think it's really, really exciting on lots of levels, selfishly, but I also think in other applications around the world, it's going to be very, very exciting.
Absolutely. It's democratizing a lot of tools that we've never had before. This is one of our staple questions. If money and resources were not constraints, what kind of intelligence and models would you wish to have, and what would you do with it?
When you say models, do you mean as a AI human model? Tool. You mean? Oh, AI, I think models. As a human model, I wouldn't mind taking 20 years off my body. That would be great, but I don't think AI can do that. Nothing can do that, I think, probably. An AI tool that helps young people to navigate some of the stresses and the strains that they're facing now, Mitty. I have two daughters, and I just see how much the young people are struggling with the future and even the present, because a lot of what we're teaching them in schools is irrelevant because it's dated. And they're facing such uncertainty and at the same time, so much social scrutiny. And I think it's a very toxic mix. So if I didn't have a budgetary constraint, I would like to find ways to create an AI that would reassure young people that at the end of the day, life comes down to people and those relationships that I mentioned at the very, very beginning, and that the technology is there to serve us, not to enslave us. So that's what my AI would do.
That is such a profound answer. That's really, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. There's so much in their growing up years. They've been bombarded with so much negativity on one side, uncertainty with, you know, the climate crisis and changes in technology. And yeah, there's so much to unpack there. That's a really great answer.
Thank you.
That's a great
world peace, of course, and world peace, Mitty, of course, world peace, and you know, and human suffering.
Absolutely.
But I can have a nice simple answer.
That's absolutely. That's a great way to end our discussion here. Appreciate you so much for taking the time. Thank you for being here, James.